You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Andrew Bordwin. Andrew, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Andrew, I know you, of course, from Taipei and now from your new venture. Maybe we should talk a little bit about what Andrew Bordwin is right now, and perhaps in the context of Taipei, which we'll talk more about, but also what your current plans or ideas are.
Yeah, sure. Well, as you mentioned, Taipei was really the main sole focus creatively as an art-making collaborative for 17 years. In the beginning, in 98, when we started working, both Adam and myself were pursuing solo careers and making our own work, making work on our own, and also making collaborative work. And that lasted for about 3 years, and then after that point, we committed to being completely collaborative and focusing on that entirely.
And then just to understand that, you know, antecedents of that, do you remember what you both were doing on your own at that time, just before you started?
Yeah, absolutely. I come from a background of photography. Adam comes from a background of video and photography as well, to be fair, but he was really much more focused on video work, and that was something that I wanted to transition into. So when we started collaborating, it was completely by accident. His then fiance was my gallerist, and we just met that way, and I started hanging out with him, and he started hanging out with me, and next thing you know, he asked me to help him to make a piece that he had in mind, and it became very clear that it was not just one guy helping out another guy, but it was a fully collaborative experience, a fully collaborative piece. And then we decided to make work following that time, when we realized that we had this shared energy, and it was quite important that we follow it through. And you know, so that lasted for a full-on 17 years and took us through a whole bunch of media. But he was working in video when we met, and making pieces that were primarily about identity, his identity within the framework of pop culture. I was making work that was more about experimental photography and some video installation work that was based on perception and the nature of recording information and how we remember things.
What was the gallery that you were in? That
at the time, it was Sarah Meltzer.
Oh, Sarah Meltzer. Okay.
Yeah. And Sarah's gallery, sadly, is no longer, but that seems to be, you know, one of the ways that galleries can go these days in Chelsea. It's tough to keep it open. She's doing other things, very interesting things now, but she hasn't had a gallery formally in a couple of years now. But, you know, so right now, well, after working within that context, the collaborative context, for 17 years, now I'm, you know, for about a year now, we've been amicably separated and decided to pursue work on our own. And he's continuing to make some work. And the focus of what I do is kind of getting back into some aspects of drawing that I have always liked to do and did to some degree while we were collaborating, but haven't really had a chance to focus on completely. So I'm kind of interested in the intersection of observation and recording, and how drawing and photography, being two ways in which those things can happen, can possibly bump up next to each other. And that sounds extremely general, because it is. It's not very specific, but without actually showing you the stuff that I'm working on, it's a little tough to describe, but that in a nutshell is kind of what I'm interested in.
It is. So then in your studio, in your studio proper, so to speak, you are actually drawing now and using photography and kind of just experimenting with these modes?
Yeah, that's right. And also starting to venture into the world of the residency, the artist residency, which, you know, that's something most of the time you do when you're a BFA or MFA and you're 25 or 30 years old and you get out there and take some time to focus on your work and all that. I never really did that. I just always just made work, right? And always had a studio, a really pretty big one and a nice one. So it's never any reason to go away. And I do have a wonderful place to work now, but I do also like at this point the power of being around other people who are focusing 100% on making art, and the energy that comes from being around, you know, within that community. So I'm also, I was in Vermont last summer at the Vermont Studio Center, which is great. I'm going to be going to Iceland next year, and so forth. So that's part of this process.
Well, that's interesting, because isn't that also the collaborative process? I mean, you know, Taipei, of course, was collaborative, and you're talking about like putting yourself back in that space, which is also what you're used to, isn't it? Or is that a stretch? I mean, it seems like that is still a collaborative space. It's a communal space, the residency.
I think it's a really good point, and I don't think it's a stretch at all. I wouldn't be collaborating with people there per se, though I'm open to that. But I have to say the collaborative model for me is a very familiar one, and it's a very comfortable and productive one. And it, I started out from the age of 14, pretty much for 20 years, I played in bands. I'm a drummer. So, and I, you know, playing in bands and getting in a van and touring around the country and recording records and putting those out, stuff like that. That was my first sort of exposure to the collaborative process. You know, at the time, if you asked me, I'd probably say it was more like the argumentative process. You're driving me up the friggin' wall process. Being in a band is not easy because you know, you're like 25 and you're canned up in this like Ford Econoline driving around the U.S. And, you know, but at the same time, you figure out a lot of things. Particularly if the band is good and if the songs are really good, and you start to think about what is it, this thing that you're making, how do you contribute to it? How do you put aside any personal differences and friction to serve this thing, which is so important clearly to everybody? It's the one thing you can all agree on. And the one time that you do really get along is when you're playing. If that's how it works, then, you know, argue all you want over breakfast. Who cares? At least the music is getting what it needs. So that was my exposure to that collaborative process. Working with Adam, obviously, was took both of us to places neither of us could have ever dreamed or imagined. It was an incredible experience, and the work continues to resonate very deeply for me. So in terms of collaborative energy within a residency, I think just being around people who are at various stages of their practice, for me, as someone who is restarting, really doing a complete reboot, is illuminating and is a relief in a way, because you get to see, okay, you're not the only one who's sort of struggling with your place in the world with this stuff. You're trying to, you know, everyone's trying to figure it out. You're not alone. And let's just get back to work. The only thing to do is to do. And there's only doing. And you may exchange some words over lunch and you get some beers at night. But other than that, you know, people are very focused. I was too.
Let's talk about the Vermont residency in that context. So, you know, that's an example of it. You go to the residency. Was that one of your first after Taipei, the Vermont residency?
That's the first one I ever went on. I've never gone on a residency. Again, you know,
And so how was it? What did you do there? Did you work there? I mean, all residencies are different. Some ask you to have plans, proposals. Others just want to leave you alone. And what was that? How did that one go for you, if you don't mind talking about it? Because that's an interesting, formative experience, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I went in without any formal plan. And I made it clear to them that I have no idea what the hell I'm going to do. And here's what I've done. Here's the position I'm in. Here are the things I'm thinking about. And they said, yeah. Everyone there was this. The nature of Vermont is the Studio Center is one of the, they really have it figured out. And they've been around for a while. The energy there is fantastic. It's run incredibly well. The quality of the writers and artists, visual artists who attend is just you know, amazing, and the opportunity to look at their work every week and to listen to readings every week. You know, Johnson, Vermont is it's a great little town. By coincidence, I've been there before, and so I kind of knew it a little bit, and I just really enjoyed it, and it was extremely productive. And you know, I have two daughters and a family and a wife, and sort of, you know, I have family that I like being with. So being away for a month would be difficult. I just did 2 weeks just to give it a shot. But, you know, it was productive. It took me in the right direction. And I want to try and kind of continue that, that focus.
So what did you have there? You had a nice space there and literally just a studio where you could paint or draw, or what were there facilities that you were able to experiment with, or how was that set up?
Well, everyone gets a studio. There were most of the visual artists that I saw there were painters. There were some people who used drawing, and then of course there were some a good bunch of sculptors as well. Everybody gets a studio, you know, their own workspace. You can close your door. I brought a whole variety of things to be ready for just about anything, and worked on one drawing project and a couple of photography projects. And just tried to not, you know, I think at a certain point the medium is, not only is the medium secondary, but really what you make is almost secondary. The process of getting is one of reconnecting with a way of thinking and sort of stretching out the creative ligaments, you know what I mean, and starting to open channels that allow you to conceive of things and figure out ways in which ideas can be expressed. It was much more of a general experience rather than a specific experience. And I did come away with some pieces, but you know, there's only so much you can do in 2 weeks.
But it is a time just to sort of step back in a sense. I mean, it's interesting too in the context of, like you're saying, a family. You're not spending months there or a month there. I would think that also the context of Vermont itself is a different, you know, the place itself is I don't know if it's typically helpful or not, but that's part of the process, right? You're walking.
It was completely removed. It was completely removed from everything. You know, I think it's a luxury. You know, it's to be able to remove yourself from day-to-day life pretty much completely. And, you know, all you're going to do today is ruminate and create and discuss again, if you're an artist who has, I've had a pretty comfortably sized studio since 97. And I continue. I moved into a new one just recently, and so I've always had a place to work. So the, you know, I think a lot of folks who go to residencies very often, certainly not all the time, but very often, the facilities that they have available at home aren't exactly what they, you know, they're not big enough, or they don't offer enough. There's too much distraction, or what have you. I've always had a place where I can just close the door and make work. So it's for me, the residency is it's not so much a need of facilities, but it's a different headspace. It's a different psychological event. Not as much as a physical one. You know, they did give me everyone gets a relatively small studio. Some people got bigger ones, and
but
you know,
successful enough that now you're going to Iceland. Like after that, coming back to your studio, I mean, this is a transitional point. So it's kind of interesting to explore. So then you're going to go to Iceland, do something similar. Is that also a few weeks or longer?
No, that's going to be. I think that's going to be 2 or 3 weeks. That's going to be next year. It's not this year. Actually, it is this year. What am I saying? It is this year now, 2016. That's well in advance, and then something. I have something in flux for this summer. We'll see if that comes through. But you know, I think that's just part of the program. I think right now is settling into a new workspace that I have now, and finding the time to do, you know.
Well, I think it's interesting talking about that we spoke about the residency, because it is part of your kind of reboot in a sense, right? It's a refocusing, re-examining of what you're doing, a new beginning, really.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And it very much feels like that. And, I moved out of my last sort of legal tenancy in New York City. Adam and I moved out of our studio space. And, you know, I've been in the city for a long time, and that was my last foothold. And happy to be in a new space up near where I live. Very, very convenient, very close, and super quiet.
Which is up in the river. So you moved from the New York to Hastings. You're up on the Hudson River, is that correct?
Yep, I live up here, and then I have my studio is just one town up in Dobbs Ferry, and it looks over the Hudson. A lot of people I know in the building, very familiar, friendly place to be. And a new space, new beginning, so it's overall it's a healthy thing.
I'd like to hear about that project, and also where, you know, if that's developing into an exhibition somewhere, but tell me about the other project and also.
Well, one other project, if you just talk about the collaborative, the power of the collaborative model, I mean, working in Taipei was, completely changed, permanently changed my approach to the collaborative process. And it's something I'd look forward to returning to. Perhaps just on a project-by-project basis, but, you know, it was such a good experience for so long, and it was so productive for so long, and I really love this idea that 1 + 1 = 3, as Adam and I used to say, the idea you put two people together, you get this third thing, and you serve that third thing kind of without ego. One of the projects that is carried over from Type A was an exhibition proposal about guns in American culture, and I'm currently pursuing that exhibition proposal with a friend of mine, Bayate Ross Smith. And Bayate is an amazing artist. Met him at NYU, where I went to school, and he's faculty at NYU, a young guy who makes incredibly compelling work, and we had this crossover of interests when it came to defining what constitutes a target in American culture, what constitutes a threat, the role of fear in American culture.
Just interrupt. Taipei also did some work on
right. So the project started
the trigger posters, right?
That's right. So the trigger posters, also the barrier project, same idea, and shot photographs, but. Now, we did a lot of work that involved defensive posture post 9/11, because we found that our work, New York City was our playground, particularly for the insertions photographs that we made, pre 9/11 and post 9/11, and that led to this, looking at political posturing and this the nature of protectionism and the fear as a commodity. And safety, real or perceived, as a commodity. And long story short, we decided that it would be really compelling to put together an exhibition as well. And the idea of artists curating is something that always interested us. So we put together this proposal, and then, we in the interim, that lost momentum, and the collaboration came to an end. But I with his blessing pretty much went forward with this idea, because I think it's really worth investigating. And so that's one project that I'm currently developing with Bayate Ross Smith. And we're looking at a couple places to exhibit it and taking it to some museum directors and curators. And we'll see where it goes. But
that's really a curatorial project.
It is a curatorial project, and it's though recognizing the fact that, you know, look, we're not curators. We're not, this is the institute, any institution that would accept this piece, this proposal, obviously we would look to again, approach with a collaborative spirit and be very open to the realities of a museum's input and influence on this exhibition. So it's not, you know, this is not, we approach it with an open mind while still being fairly protective of the essential core of the show. So that's something else that's going on that is really collaborative, where I am working with Biotay, but, you know, it's on this one project. Who knows where else it could go, but for now, that's, you know, that's another example of how the collaborative approach is carried over into what I'm doing today, and hopefully this exhibition will find some legs and find a home. So we're working on multiple fronts to make that happen.
That's exciting, and then there's also your day job, so to speak, your design work. Is that correct? Are you still continuing that?
Well, I'm a photographer and filmmaker. I've always supported myself. You know, I do, you know, have sort of multiple eclectic ways to make money, but and support myself. Selling art is definitely one of them, but being a commercial photographer and commercial video, you know, filmmaker has always been the way I do that. And so the filmmaking, that's, you know, I started a company called Milkbox, and Milkbox is also a venture with a friend of mine who's someone I know nearby. Where I live. So that's also, that's, you know, very much of a collaborative approach, the way we make movies. Movie making is far more collaborative right off the truck than photography, in the sense that, you know, you always have, you have to have a big crew. You in photography, you can just sort of have a camera. Maybe you have an assistant with you who does what you tell him or her to do, but and maybe you work together to achieve the kind of images you want to achieve. But in movie making, for the most part, you know, you got to have a bigger crew than that to really achieve anything of considerable scope. You know, you need to have people in place, and you need to be able to work collaboratively. So I find myself once again, you know, attracted to that medium because it is so collaborative, and, you know, motion work for me is a lot more, has been a big growth over the past 3 years or so. And I do that commercially and you know, and also you reach a lot more people than you do with art sometimes. You know, we recently did a video for the Downtown Alliance, which is an organization in Lower Manhattan, a BID, and they hired us in two separate rounds to do some work that sort of tells the story of the rebirth of Lower Manhattan. And one of our videos, which has Questlove as the sort of celebrity centerpiece, has been seen conservatively over 5 million times. So it's like, you know, it's one of those things that you realize the scope of commercial exposure is so far greater than for most contemporary artists. You don't really, it's much more of a niche, insulated world in contemporary art.
It's very interesting. But that at the same time, I was, imagine that also influences how you're approaching your own work and collaborations that influence.
I mean, I think it's almost, you know, in that sense,
I mean, that's what artists want, right? We want that kind of reach, that sort of, you know, million views or whatever it is, you know.
The trigger posters, oddly enough, I mean, the trigger posters, you know, if you talk about those were posters that we did as a project connected with an exhibition at the Aldrich Museum in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And we went shooting at a shooting range, Adam and I saw these posters of scenarios of people holding hostages and pointing guns at bad guys and all this sort of this strange portrayal of threat in poster form that you could buy for, you know, $1.99 at the shooting range and then clip up and send it out there and shoot it up. We decided to do our own, and now we have 60 of them that are being sold by law enforcement targets. That's the Trigger Project. Those things have sold, as of, you know, this month, approximately 1 million posters. So that's,
oh, that's fantastic. I didn't realize that project was that commercial. That's a wonderful kind of crossover.
They're
buying them for target practice.
That's right. Around America, they've been in Doomsday Preppers. They've, you know, somebody sent us a frame grab showing how they were made an appearance in that bizarre show. I mean, the people are buying these things. They sell about 20,000 of them a month, more or less. And, you know, we get beer money out of it. We just get pennies, but it's not about the money at all. But what's interesting is that we chose.
But it does sound like an income. I mean, that's something that worked. That really worked.
Well, you know, we'll make a few hundred bucks a month between the two of us. You know, we split it. We're grateful for it. It's not nothing, but
when I say
we sold a million posters, it sounds like we're, you know, about to retire on a bunch of posters, and that's simply not even close to being the case. But the point of that project that I think is so interesting in terms of commercial exposure is that we chose a vehicle, a distribution vehicle that goes far beyond the limitations of contemporary art. Contemporary art is very limited, niche, community where people tend to sort of all know each other, and then they see each other in Miami, and then they see each other in Basel, and they bump into each other in Chicago and LA and Boston and New York, and then do it all over again. And I think, you know, not to sound like a jerk, but I just, you know, that conversation when you talk, if you do projects the way Adam and I have done, where you're working with just regular folks who, like, generally don't have any exposure to or connection to contemporary art, or don't particularly care about it or get it, or maybe they're intimidated by it or whatever. I mean, the relevance of what we do is just so limited to the world at large. And with Trigger, what we did is we created what we considered to be art. We created art objects, which are these photographs that depict threat in American society, a whole variety.
Well, usually a person pointing a gun at you, more or less, right?
Pointing a gun at the camera, or pointing a gun at someone's, at a hostage's head. It's usually one of those two scenarios, or just standing there looking vacant and threatening, which also happens. But, you know, we did a series in a liquor store holdup. We did a series in the Aldrich with the staff from the Aldrich that was called, ended up being marketed as workplace violence. We did a series of real-life zombies. We did a series of urban threats, sort of like in the city, in the streets, and that was, you know, a whole other experience. But we take this art, and we then insert it into the marketplace, where law enforcement targets sees the pictures, they accept the ones they want, they print them up in batches of 10,000, they sell them, and then it ceases to be art. So it's sort of like appropriation turned inside out, right? So appropriation is this idea that you take that urinal, you take it off the wall, you put it on a pedestal, and you call it art. You take a functional object, you make it useless, and then it becomes art. And we're taking objects that we consider art, and then we're putting in the marketplace where they cease to be art. So it's a complete
But why do they cease to be art? In a way, you could say they still are art. It's like if a piece of art is, you know, printed in a newspaper a million times, it's still a work of art, isn't it? You could say the original photograph is.
But the only people in the world really who would acknowledge those posters, you know, if public acknowledgement is the barometer of art, right? If some kind of some level of public acknowledgement is what defines art as being art, then our stuff is not art, because the only people who know that it started out that way is basically, you know, it's a handful of people. It's Adam and myself, and now you, and, you know, Richard Klein at the Aldrich, and a few other people, and that's it. So nobody, you know, if you see a Fred Conrad, photographer for the New York Times, right? You know, fantastic storied photographer for the time. A lot of what he does is very, very practical. It's just about telling, you know, reporting the news. But a lot of his work is just, you know, it's art. It's phenomenally art. And despite its utilitarian quality, there's a lot of people who know his name, who understand what he does, and will acknowledge it as art in the paper, for sure. With us, there's nobody out there who, you know, people get these things, they clip them up in a shooting range, or they pin them to a tree, or whatever they do, and then they either keep them as a lot of people keep target posters when they come back from the range, just to show how well or how badly they did, and they hang them up in a room,
right.
Or maybe they just throw them out. But you know, nobody's looking at these things thinking this is an art project, and it has to do with how we portray fear in America today, and the idea of what we, you know, this inverse of appropriation, what this term that I made up called interappropriation, the idea that, you know, you're taking art and sticking it in the marketplace where it stops being art. You know, it's art for our purposes, but, you know, for the public, in the public realm and public consumption, it's got nothing to do with art. And I think that's kind of refreshing. And meanwhile, these things are, by my count, I lost count, and I have yet to get a full count of how many have moved out there, but it's definitely over a million by now. So that's kind of a nutty level, and it's nationwide, you know, so who knows where they are? We have no idea where they are.
But it sounds like people, at some point you gave up control over them in some ways by letting, I mean, as opposed to printing the posters and having a company that prints these and sells these, you've also, sounds like, almost kind of licensed the images. They print them up, they sell them, they're out of your hands fairly quickly. You're not involved
at all. That release is really gratifying for us, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so much of art making is characterized by clinging tight to it and saying, hey, this is mine, it's my copyright, it's my intellectual property, belongs to me, I need to know where it is, I need to keep track of where the editions are,
right,
being distributed,
to control how the images is being made or something. You could have easily kept control over all of that, right?
That's right. And so for us, I mean, the whole process, and this is something that I think, you know, this is the aspect of what Taipei did that doesn't often get talked about a lot, and I've said this to a few people, but it's, you know, there's a spiritual aspect to it as well, in the sense that, you know, if you're possessive about your work, regardless of what it is, it's going to be a limitation. I mean, I think a big thing that's sort of liberating about this particular project is that it was like so many other things we did, was characterized by release and by letting go and not clinging tight to it, not hanging on to it, not, you know, holding on for dear life. You just like trust the damn thing and let it, you know, let it go out into the world. And that's part of its content. That's actually part of what defines it. And so that's part of what that's a central part of what I like so much about that project, is that release.
Andrew, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure hearing about your work. I wish you the best in your new work as well as it's been great talking about Taipei. So good luck with everything, and look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thanks so much, Brainerd. Appreciate it. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.